Okay, I would like to thank the organizers for this chance to be in this wonderful environment. So I'll talk about training shape memory alloys, and the word memory is already here. So, and the training, so those are the keywords that I've heard a lot during this conference. So we'll try to see if we can make sense of them in this context. So we will be talking about structural phase transitions. It's a first order phase transitions in crystals. And for instance, this is a high symmetry phase. Let's say it's present here as a square. And you may have low symmetry phase, this oblique configuration, maybe represented by two twins. So here we can think about Landau type theory with a one well corresponding to austenite and two other wells corresponding to martensitic twins. In 3D we may have more complex situation. This is a high symmetry, let's say a cubic phase, and low symmetry tetragonal phase, and it's represented by three wells, three energy wells, let's say, and three twins. So this seemed to be very
and
well.
And those three twins are, each one of those is degenerate in three different directions, is that?
Yeah, there are three different energy wells corresponding to these three configurations that are symmetry related, and together they the whole configuration retains the symmetry of the cubic phase, but each one of them breaks the symmetry. So it's a first order phase transition, seem to be nothing really one can expect interesting here. But if we look at experiments, this is experiments with nickel titanium, which is a typical shape memory alloy. You see this hysteresis, again, nothing special. But you see the serrations here. That's the first thing to pay attention to. And the second thing is that you need several runs to stabilize this cycle. And in fact, in shape memory alloy business, they, it's a shape memory because overall response is elastic or almost elastic. So elasticity is, in a sense, its ultimate shape memory. So there is a concept of training. So you need to do something with this alloy in order to stabilize its response. Usually it's it's a certain protocol of loading, and loading not only by physical loads, but also varying temperature. And you see that when we vary temperature in those alloys, you also see some serrations. Not only serrations, but you see scale-free serrations. This is acoustic emission. This is the colorimetric measurements. So that gives a hint that there is some complexity behind this. And
sorry, scale free in the height of those spikes?
Sorry?
So what is scale free here?
Yeah, but here you see there is, if you resolve this, you also see intermittency. But later we'll see that you can talk about some range of scale-free behavior.
So I don't understand the heat flux spikes. I mean, acoustics, I guess, I mean, it's the same thing, just energy released in different forms.
Yeah, so colorimetric measurements, they see the response to monotone loading in temperature, and the system responds intermittently. So those are experiments for this particular shape memory alloy. This is in stress control. This is in strain control. So this is the loading path. You don't see the whole hysteresis, but you see acoustic emission quite considerable. And when people looked at the distribution of avalanches or events here, they see power laws over several decades. So that's the main question. So you are having a first order phase transition where you don't expect scale-free behavior other than in a critical point. And here you have a robust power law structure of the fluctuations where you don't tune anything. But what you do is this training, this kind of either thermal, usually they say it's a 50 cycles of thermal loading and unloading, or mechanical, but it's usually know-how in these companies who sell those alloys. So that's the puzzle. How can you have in the system with first order phase transition this type of response? Now, this shows that it's not only for those particular alloys, there are many alloys. This is a table showing different exponents. They're not all exactly the same, but they've been measured experimentally for different type of first order phase transitions. Maybe you don't see the details here, but you have plenty of measurements in different type of alloys. So there is also spatial complexity. If you look at the microstructures that develop in those alloys, you see those also apparently complex microstructures with many coexisting scales. That's, for instance, how the new phase is growing. This is the austenitic phase, this is martensites. In the textbook examples, we have usually those very kind of organized habit planes with martensite nicely twins geometrically, but in fact, in real samples, there is quite a lot of complexity develops during the growth. And for instance, when you cyclically deform those alloys, you may be in the same point on the hysteresis cycle and having quite different and complex microstructure. So this all suggests that there is some complexity associated with the first order phase transition. But the question is, what kind of model can capture it?
Where did these colors come from, roughly speaking? How are they made? Do you know?
Yeah, it's a reflection of light. Different, I think, different twins with different orientations. I wouldn't be able to say more, but yeah. But it's a structure of twins. Which means that this low energy state is degenerate in the discrete way, and those kind of bottoms of the wells, you make patterns and structures. And so those different colors, they reflect the presence of the material is kind of sitting in different wells, and I guess it can be visualized.
So each color corresponds to a different
one
of those three minima that you were telling us about.
Yeah, but they're equivalent kind of energetically and symmetry related in a sense. Now, there is a theory that Karen is an author of this together with Jim Sethna that people try to apply in this case. So it's a random fieldizing model driven system in non-equilibrium way. So you can also, if here it's a hard spin version, but you can make a soft spin version. So you also have a hysteresis and you also have a power law structure of the fluctuations, but only for special value of disorder. So here H is a driving parameter, which is the analog of stress in mechanical tests, and HI which is linearly coupled with a spin variable, it's a disorder that's modeled by Gaussian distribution with a certain variance R. And you do see power law. So here it's a subcritical because you have a peak. Here you have a, supercritical. It's a subcritical with a cutoff. But for particular disorder, you observe power law. But it's for particular disorder. The question is, in order to apply this model, we have to understand how the system finds this disorder, because we take generic sample, we are not particularly adjusting it, and still we have a power law. So this cannot be applied directly to those experiments.
Is this exponent of the power law something that's universal?
Here it's universal for random field Ising model, but as I showed for shape memory alloys, in phase transitions with different symmetry, you have different exponents. Okay, so now let's go back to training. So if we carefully watch, so this was a kind of mild version of it, that you have like three runs before it converges, but those are other experiments where you need more runs before you converge to a stable response, which is what is expected of good shape memory alloy. So there is some evolution here, and you see there is some residual strain develops. Also, it looks like a power law is not seen at the first runs, and you need several runs before you start to see a power law. So this is an exponent, this is this match, so it really becomes power law with lambda tending to zero after 20, 30 cycles. So it looks like this training, in addition to bringing us to a reproducible response, it also brings us to the state with a kind of quasi-critical behavior.
Yes, so, I'm sorry, maybe you've said this, but what are the different letters here? What is P, A, and L?
This is a probability, this is amplitude of avalanche, this is distribution of avalanches. Here it's amplitude, it could have been also energy released. So here you see it converges, and this is the attempt to match those curves, but for many more cycles, here it's up to 9, up to 30, by this type, the distribution of avalanches by this formula, and you see that alpha stabilizes with cycles and lambda goes to zero.
And so once you're in that state where you take these pictures of the three colors, is that done stroboscopically invariant?
This, I don't think it has been done. It's a good thing to check, but looks like it's only statistically reproducible, because as you've seen some of the pictures that I've shown, it's for kind of mature hysteresis loop where people still see geometrically variable pattern, but maybe it's superficially different in terms of kind of organization. It's the same, so it's like a different turbulent flow in developed turbulence, the same. But so those are other experiments where people try stress-driven and strain-driven. This is for energies, this distribution. This is for amplitudes. You see several decades. And again, you see that the exponents here, epsilon and here alpha, converge after 30, 40 cycles. And this is what those companies are supposedly doing before the alloy is stable. So that represents a kind of mystery. We have some evidence of kind of critical behavior in the first order phase transition, and we need some way of understanding it.
So can I just ask, you're saying you're training it, and I'm a little confused as to where you're training. So that is, this is a shape memory alloy, and so there's a very high temperature where you have to go to make the sample, and then there's a lower temperature where if you had gone below that, you could have made it some other shape, and then you go above that temperature, and it brings back to it. So where is it? I mean, so when you talk about these trainings and these avalanches, I'm not quite sure I know where this is being done.
So training is just loading and unloading. It may be by stresses, by displacements, by temperature, but you drive the system through the hysteresis cycle, which means that you go all the way from austenite to martensite, that's represented by these complex mixtures, and then back to austenite, where the mixture disappears, and back to the complex state, and it then returns, and so on.
Kind of ignorant of what martensite and austenite and all these. I just assume that they're something, but which one of these is the...
Maybe I go back to the first slide, which kind of illustrates it.
So that A is the austenite.
So A is the high symmetry phase, is called austenite. It's just because in some metallurgical applications, those phase transitions resurfaced first, but you may think it's just an elastic phase transition between two solid phases with two different symmetries. And so high symmetry phase is called austenite, and low symmetry phase is called martensite. So they're elastic, they're not diffusional, so there is no compositional changes. So it's just like a liquid vapor phase transition, just in liquid vapor you have the same symmetry, and here you have different symmetries in two phases.
And theta here represents temperature?
Temperature. But also you may drive the transition by increasing stress. For instance, if you shear highly symmetric phase, it's you kind of bias a low symmetry phase, and that can be one.
But you don't bias them all evenly then.
Yeah, but there is a compatibility problem because all the parameters are gradients. In your sample, you may not, if it's constrained on the boundary, you may not be able to get just one well. So you have to, as energy is being minimized, you may have to form a complex mixture to adjust it, unless you are very specially oriented and okay.
So,
sorry.
Yes. Going between M1 and M2 and M3, you don't regard that as a phase transition for you.
Yeah, that's a good question. In fact, phase transition is the lowering of the symmetry of it. Just that this, it's a bit like buckling. So you may buckle in one direction or in the other if you have in a plane a bar. So those are equivalent configurations of the same phase. So the main phase transition is between A and the combination of M's. It's just the specifics of this low symmetry systems that you, in liquid vapor, you have, for instance, isotropy. So you have infinite number of twins, if you want, with different orientations. But here you have discrete number of twins. So that's what brings specifics here to the system.
I just want to understand a little bit more, like if I purchased some shape memory alloy and it had not been properly trained, what about it would lead me to reject it?
Yeah, if it's actuator, so it will not be reproducible in different cycles, so you cannot expect exactly the same response. So, because it's just forming its kind of optimal state, And after it's set, the phase transition runs through the highways always on the same way. As so I many of those kind of systems that stabilize with cyclic loading.
So I would try to put a memory in this by this temperature, you know, deforming it at a higher temperature and then cool it down. But I would find then that the first time I tried to recall this memory, it would behave differently than the second time, than the third time.
Yeah.
And so the shape that I program would not hold.
In fact, probably, you know, this is, when you're doing this at the company, you're probably cycling it to much heavier loads, meaning that in practice, once you have it in the cycle, I suspect you're just sort of, you know, just, you know, your actuator is just operating in a very limited part of it, which means that probably it's, you know, if your activator is going to do the training, it's probably going to take a lot longer because the typical loads of your, you know, usage of the device will be, you know, much less than you know, where he trains it.
You're saying that putting this memory in, as the end user, as it were, putting this memory in is going to take longer because
presumably
I'm going to use it for smaller loads than it was.
I mean,
no, in a sense, you are, the goal of training is to put some memory and then the system remembers it. You actually build infrastructure inside, and then it's all the nucleation sites are properly organized by material, and then it goes in every cycle. It goes in the same way,
so,
but it's still complexity is there. So it's not that it leads to some simple limit cycle.
Okay,
it's
so
a
then
complex,
maybe it's
tractor.
This training, maybe I didn't understand. This training is done by the people who make the material.
Yeah.
And then
you can also do it at home.
You can also do it at home when, well, no, but I'm saying once you buy this material, right, and you have a particular application in mind, you then do another training of many cycles to get it to that. Like,
no, but then
how does
you have already reproducible behavior, so you cannot change this memory. The material already remembers it, and it's optimal for this material, and it just goes until it breaks. Fatigue failure is the typical thing here. At some point, cracks form,
I think this is what Sid was getting at. That this is when we talk about shape memory alloys. This is the memory that we're putting in by this repeated.
I think your applications would basically correspond to operating, you know, using readout cycles at amplitudes less, or possibly significantly less, than the cycle at which the company has trained it and delivered it to you. That's probably, they will probably tell you, you know, this is this alloy that has been kind
of.
Yeah,
there are internal cycle, there is a return point memory here, there are many things that I just emit here. So it's not necessarily that in applications you use the whole cycle all the time.
Yes, so
but clearly you prime your system in a some kind of mysterious way, and that's the something to understand.
Okay. Sorry, thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
You crumple your Mylar a whole bunch of times.
All right, so we need a model.
This is where the talk begins.
Yeah.
You just came up with the right time.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
No problem. No problem. So the main idea that we try to kind of use is that as we see residual strain developing, we expect that there is a limited dislocational activity here in addition to phase transition. And that's what creates memory. So there is in addition to a usual order parameter of a phase transition, there is a co-evolving other field that is, in this case, it's a field of defects, but in this case, it will be a field of dislocations, and it co-evolves, and together they so in a sense, this co-evolving fields creates the anneal disorder that is ensuring that the system robustly pass near the critical manifold. So that's the primary idea that we try to follow, because
co-evolving dislocations and what?
Oh, there is a order parameter of phase transition, yes, that tells you in which well the system is, and but in addition, there is something else is happening. So we don't have here any quench disorder, because we could put a quench disorder, because as we remember from random fieldizing model, you need a very particular disorder, and this disorder has to emerge somehow. So we need a kind of agent that that can ensure this disorder, and it can co-evolve together with the main phase transition. So that's the kind of idea which we try to implement now. Yes?
I'm sorry if I say anything that you talked about.
No problem. But,
so the plasticity in these systems comes in sort of two broad categories, right? One is you have the dislocation which mediate plasticity of normal metals, or normal solid, crystalline solids, but you have the martensitic order, which is also
but martensite, it's a kind of reversible plasticity. You have a plateau, you have an yield, but when you unload, the system almost returns to its original state. So in a sense, neighbors remain neighbors. Yes. So in this situation, you don't have this memory formation. So we are saying that occasionally some particles are changing their neighbors, and it's really very limited. It's not really plasticity. And to emphasize this, we'll be dealing with thermal driving, which means that we increase temperature and decrease temperature. So we're not tilting our landscape in any way. So it will be really wimpy plasticity. But it's exactly enough plasticity to ensure that the complexity form is there. And it's people recorded dislocations in martensitic phase transitions. So they are there, and the fact that there are residual strain, that after a few cycles the system evolves, so that's suggestive that there is there are some formation of defects. But pure picture of martensitic phase transition does not allow for any defects to form.
You don't include things like twinning.
Like what?
Twinning in a crystal.
No, I do include. Because we have this low symmetry phase represented by few wells, so when they coexist, this is twinning.
Okay.
All right. So it's going to be a model, what is called mesoscopic. So we have a lattice, and so each element of a lattice is viewed as involving many particles, and then it experiences deformation. So those particles internally are kind of enslaved, kind of Cauchy-Born hypothesis. So atoms would follow a fine transformation, but overall you may have inhomogeneous deformation here. Now, how to distinguish phase transition and plasticity? So phase transition, for instance, when you go from square to oblique, there are four different twins, and you can use Landau type of concept, effective potential with four different wells at low temperatures. But you can also describe in this scheme plasticity. For this, you need to notice that if you take a lattice and shear it enough, you are going to get the same lattice again. Yes? So you see here this beta is this kind of shift here. And when this beta becomes equal to the atomic spacing, then your lattice vectors have been deformed, but the symmetry of the original lattice was recovered. So that suggests that you can combine Landau picture and plasticity into one framework if you associate with these cells a particular energy. And this energy must allow for these many symmetric states. So there are two types of wells. There are Landau wells, but there are also these lattice invariant wells where the system reproduces itself. So this is how dislocations would look in this scheme, for instance. This deformation brings us to the same lattice. Those reds domains, they look differently, but if you look at the lattice vectors, they describe exactly the same lattice. So if our system allows configurations like this, where here there is a considerable shear, then in fact it's a continuous description of formation of a dislocation loop or a pair of dislocations. So you can have an approach which really sees both phase transition, which would be a small shear, and plasticity, which would be a large shear. So in fact, one can think in terms of energy density for those cells. So C is the measure of deformation. You measure the distances and the angles between these lattice vectors. And what you need to assume is that there is this global infinite symmetry here in this energy, which means that if there is a matrix M, integer valued, that brings the lattice to itself, then the energy must have this symmetry. So in a sense, this is far-reaching generalization of Franklin-Contarello model. It's just that you assume this periodicity not for in a particular layers inside the crystal, but all over. So there is a global symmetry. So you can imagine this kind of very bumpy energy landscape with a particularly geometrically related wells. And in fact, this idea was first proposed by Jerry Erickson in 1980, and more recently it was elaborated by Conti and Zanzotto. So you may think about this as a continuum mechanics, but with this multi-well, with the energy with infinite number of wells, and that would allow one to describe plasticity in this seemingly elastic setting. Okay, this is just illustrates this point. For instance, we can look at the plane C11, it's an extension in the one direction, and C12, it's a shear, and C22, let's say, eliminated by this condition. And then we can apply shear deformation, and we move in the space. If you take geometrical nonlinearity into account, it's not going to be just changing C12, there will be also changing C11. So you evolve, but then eventually you get to another well which is equivalent to the original well. So there will be some barriers in between. And that's how the global picture can be put together. So this rectangle, this triangle that we've seen on the previous slide, this represents the basic neighborhood where, which is then repeated symmetrically, and that is the structure of the energy landscape. So real transition from square to oblique would require this path and also symmetric path here in nonlinear elasticity, but we just, for simplicity, we drop these two other variants. So you can shear in this direction, you can shear in this direction, and view this as a one path, so that this would allow us to get a scalar model. So this is square, this is square, this is square lattice, and those tilted states are also equivalent. So for instance, to find the energy, the value of the energy here, you have to map it, that's called Lagrange reduction, to the fundamental neighborhood, and then reconstruct the energy. So you only need to know the structure of the energy in this fundamental neighborhood, which is actually Landau neighborhood, where you have a phase transition. But then you symmetrically extend this neighborhood over the whole space of strains. And that's how you learn how to construct this energy. So this is a cartoon of how this type of energy would look like. So this is austenitic wells. This is the value of the temperature where the preferred phase is the square phase. But you see the square phase is represented by many equivalent wells. Those are martensitic wells, but they are also have many kind of analogs. So plasticity, so the idea is that phase transition is happening here, but occasionally the system makes detours away from this neighborhood, and that's where the neighbors, the nearest neighbors change, even though the description is continuous. But if you start drawing counting who are the nearest neighbors, in fact, when you cross through this barrier, you form defects. But otherwise, description is completely continuous, and it allows to describe both plasticity and phase transition.
So this is still when you're in the regime where the symmetric phase is favorably created.
Yeah. But you see what the way we are going to drive it, we are going to have a function that would change the relevant depth of the wells. So if loading can be viewed as just tilting of this landscape, the thermal loading would be more like a shaking of this landscape. So we want to achieve those states by this type of cyclic changing of this length, of this kind of relative height of these two wells. Okay. All right, so now to be more specific, to have a scalar model on a plane, we assume that y component, so it's kind of highly anisotropic, so there is no deformation in the y direction, so it's only x component of displacement. Ij is the coordinates of a particular cell, is different from zero, so in a sense you may think about rails. And atoms can, not atoms, but those kind of cells can deform while maintaining the parallelism of these lines. So there are two strain variables, one characterizing the kind of shear in your elementary unit, and another is extension of xx direction. So this will be a primary order parameter, and this will be a secondary order parameter. Now, there are compatibility relations also, as usually in elasticity, because those are strains, yes? So they are gradients. So because of this, there are compatibility relations that the overall curvature is zero. So that allows you to eliminate secondary order parameter, would allow us to eliminate secondary order parameter and finally formulate the theory only in terms of variable beta, but the interaction between the units will become non-local.
So the alphas are sort of uniaxial string.
Yeah, it's like a stretching of this. While this one is a relative displacement for the column.
So this is shear string.
Yeah.
And you're setting UY to be zero just for simplicity, and there's no physical, I mean.
No, you may think that you model highly anisotropic crystals like HCP would be versus FCC, but yeah, it's just to make a scalar model. We also now, by now, we have also a fully tensorial model, but it's not yet ready. So this is, I would say, minimal model, because you need, of course, this order parameter to have the this complex energy landscape, but you also need non-locality. You need this kind of propagators with the right decay and with the antiferromagnetic part. So for this, you need another variable that is quadratic. So that's, in fact, what I want to say next. So we need to formulate the energy. That's the energy density over sites. So in terms of alpha, it will be quadratic. And in terms of beta, it will have this this type of structure. So you can formulate this energy. So for instance, we are going to use piecewise quadratic, because ultimately we would like to eliminate, to integrate out all linear variables and reduce it to automaton, to a kind of spin type model. So for this, we need to have elasticity present in a very rudimentary way. Okay, so those are a collection of quadratic wells. Now we have what appeared here are two numbers, this S. It's a spin variable that takes value 0, 1, and minus 1. It tells you in which of these three wells you are. And D, which tells us in which neighborhood you are. So D is a discrete, it's an integer valued parameter that measures plasticity, the kind of in the system. And S is a parameter that measures phase transition. So we have a co-evolving here, phase transition, and the parallel plasticity is taking place in the background. Yes.
So D is related to dislocation.
Yes. Yes. Roughly, curl D is the dislocation density. D is asleep. So So okay. Okay, now you can, as I said, kind of adiabatically eliminate the linear part of the model and reduce it to a spin model. But S are the this spins. Taking value minus 1, 0, and 1, and D are spins taking integer values. And there are interaction kernels appearing between them. And so there is, I'm not putting here the, there are, you can explicitly compute these kernels by taking advantage of compatibility relations, which I'm not putting in detail. I'm just showing the picture of the structure of this matrix. It has this, it's not sign definite, so you have like in usual in elasticity, but it's a bimodal rather than bipole rather than quadrupole, because it's highly anisotropic crystal. But otherwise, it's like Eshelby kind of kernel.
Almost understand the energy in terms of the term. So epsilon is a global strain, and what is tau? The next
line,
in the first line.
Tau, it's our driving. So we're driving it through this quadratic term. In random field azimuthal, you drive through linear term, but here, it's, since there are two equivalent twins, it's...
Yeah,
it decides the relative depths of the wells. So that will be a periodically changing function. Now, the decay is 1 over r squared, as you expected from elasticity. So in fact, elasticity is present here, kind of adequately, even though we don't use directly these Eshelby solutions. It's just the inversion of this matrix is equivalent. And what we put here is, if you look at the part related to S, it has this quadratic part in S, like in Ising models, but with a long-range interaction. Plus, it has the linear part, where H is, in fact, is controlled by D. So we interpret this as a new disorder. Of course, we could write it explicitly in terms of D as a coupling term between S and D, but it's convenient to write it as H because if we just look at evolution of S, it looks as if S evolves under the influence of the disorder, which is not quenched, but which is evolves by itself with plastic deformation. So what phase transition is seeing, it's as if there is a disorder there that is evolving. And the idea is that this disorder is evolving in a particular way, and it's bringing this system to some kind of preferred complex state, which one needs to understand.
So C is what's left of the driving, right, in this cross screen?
Tau is a function of T. So driving is through this coefficient. Yeah.
And then the C is what does it correspond to the original F?
Ah, sorry. C is the coupling between alpha and beta.
Okay.
C is this coefficient. But at the end, we take a particular value of C here, this is just... we also explore dependence on C, which I'm not going to discuss here. So there's no C, yeah.
So the top free energy, this is equivalent, right? Yes. So the J came from the betas that you have as a...
Yeah, it came from these compatibility conditions and also from the fact that the wells are quadratic. So you take everything in the model that is linear, suppose you fix your integer value of the parameter, then the problem of minimizing this energy is quadratic. So you just invert this matrix and you have this with the appropriate decay. So all elasticity has been compressed into this J. All right, so with all these variables elastic adiabatically eliminated, we can still consider dynamics over damped. Moreover, we assume that the driving is slow in the sense that at the time scale of the driving, the relaxation, this kind of gradient flow is infinitely fast. So this is infinity if you want. So you're always sitting in local minima of this energy, and then occasionally you switch between those local minima, and those switches will represent avalanches. So it's like in all these type of models, it's the same. But the idea is that you don't want to resolve this fast processes in computations because it's very expensive, so you have these jumps so it's a kind of overdamped dynamics. You stay in the local minimum till it's ceased to exist, and then you jump to the ones that can be reached by gradient flow. All right, so we do cyclic thermal driving, and then
uh,
Sorry.
This is a,
it's
this
very
is,
slow dynamic.
This is from a different. Maybe I put this slide from a different paper. Yeah, let's go here. So this is a typical configuration of S after a few cycles. And then the anneal disorder is, which is this H of S, represented by this graph. This is a field H. So that's the kind of disorder that the field S is seeing after a few cycles. Okay.
You actually assume some kind of a big difference in the dynamics of the two variables. I mean, one is this zero plus minus one, the other is the integer variable. So their dynamics happening at the same time scale or
at the same time scale. So it's infinitely fast. So the system is always in terms of S and D, it's always in a local minimum. And then it switches to another one. So all these internal relaxations are faster than the driving, so it's resistant. All right. So this is Q is a parameter character. It's a kind of average transformation degree of transformation. So when tau is our temperature. So epsilon is very important parameter. It's you cannot see here. This is epsilon. It shows you the location of this well. So when epsilon is close to 1/2, sorry, you cannot see it, then this barrier is very small and plasticity is easy. When epsilon is close to 0, this well is very close. This Martin Sittig well is very close to austenite, and plasticity is miles away. So you expect really this anneal disorder to be relevant only when epsilon is close to 1/2. So here there are two values. One epsilon is far away from 1/2, another is quite close to 1/2. So here you see this boxy hysteresis. So that gives you the degree of transformation. This is, let's say, austenite, this is martensite. And this is delta is the measure of disorder. The first moment of H is equal to 0, and this is the variance of disorder. And you see that, so this shows the number of the cycle. It's from 0 to 20. So you see this disorder is rather limited. So which means that when this well is very close to austenitic well, and this barrier is far away, there is practically no plasticity. And as a result, you don't see much of the evolution of your hysteresis loop. It's kind of was initially boxy, and it remains boxy. However, if you start changing this parameter epsilon, you allow more and more of this plasticity, and for instance, for value 0.48, you have a full-fledged evolution of disorder. So it's also this quenched. This is anneal disorder, so it's breathing as the system goes through the cycle, and you see that also your hysteresis cycle is rounding, becoming nice and symmetric. And that's when they sell you your shape memory alloy, that it's kind of, it has been trained, and it's that's what you expect. But at the expense of this parallel order parameter doing its job, which is a big mystery. What is it doing? So here there are two experiments where we start with, we can plant initially dislocations, of course, in the system. And this is a dislocation density. And for instance, the state one is when it's very clean, there are almost no dislocations. And state two is when there are many dislocations at the very beginning. So that would be like initial quenched disorder. And so as a result, the first cycle for state one is this very boxy, and the first cycle for state two is already nice and round. But as you continue to cycle, no matter what was your initial condition, the system forgets initial condition and seems to be, sorry, it's not a memory, it's anti-memory in a sense. But then it finds some state with a particular configuration of the density of dislocations. Of course, there are still fluctuations here. And then it's get into this canonical hysteresis, which is given by three, which is has the shape of what we've seen on previous graph.
So I'm sorry. The temperature cycle that you're doing, this is all now sitting in the Martensite.
No, you go from Martensite to austenite. So you increase temperature so that you bias high symmetry phase, then you lower the temperature, you again bias low symmetry phase, and you go through it, and the system seems to be evolving towards this attractor, like develop turbulence in a sense.
So the zero is where? Somewhere.
Zero is between. So let's say positive temperature favors austenite, and negative value, of course, not the temperature, it's the function of temperature. Negative value enters favors low symmetry phase. Yeah. Okay, now let's look at how this parameter, this variance of disorder, this of O'Neill disorder evolves with the number of cycles. So we cycle between full austenite and martensite, and we measure in this maximum delta in martensite and maximum in a limiting points when of our cycle. And you see that there are oscillations, there are some fluctuations, very severe, of both quantities. And then after certain cycles, it reached the perfect state, it fully stabilized. So it's quite dramatic. So those are like chaotic transients in dynamical systems, and then it reached this state, and then it stays there. So that's a perfect alloy to be solved. Now, if you look at the number of cycles till stabilization, this depends on parameter epsilon. This, you remember that epsilon close to 1/2 means that plasticity is really easy. And when epsilon is small, plasticity is difficult. So when plasticity is difficult, then stabilization happens rather quickly. While as you start opening up your landscape, because when epsilon goes to 1/2, more and more, bigger and bigger landscape becomes available to the system. And it has more and more difficulty to find this special state. So there is an exponential growth in epsilon and also in the size of the system. So finally, near this point, of course, we could not make computations here, but it takes infinite time. And this shows the average value of this variance of disorder in martensite minus the average value in austenite. So when epsilon was small, they were small and close to each other. So you practically didn't have any disorder in the system. Plasticity was practically non-existent. Then there is a range where plasticity starts to appear. And this plays maybe playing a role of order parameter, distinguishing between these two states. One is when you achieve, as a result of this shakedown, the hysteresis with the breathing and plasticity present, and one which is kind of stuck, and all dislocations are kind of absorbing state. So now we can speculate that you can associate yield that exists in stress-driven systems with this point 0.5. While before you have this long stochastic transients, and this may be interpreted as these pre-yield configurations in stress-driven plasticity. But here, its plasticity is very limited, so it's all phase transition practically. But complexity is observed at this stage, so it's associated with this long transients because the system still sees a very complex energy landscape, and it's before it reaches those kind of confined and deterministic states, if you want, it explores this the whole complexity of this landscape, and in particular it shows the power law structure of the fluctuations. Now, so critical point was mentioned before. We still need to understand why there is a why there are power laws here. So what we can do is to look at this is how average disorder evolves as you go from austenite to martensite. Here you are changing temperature, lowering the temperature. And then there is a special value, tau critical. And if you look at the distribution of avalanches, you see that the scaling develops near, in a quite localized way, near a particular value of this temperature. So it looks as if the system passes somewhere near critical manifold. So there is a critical point in the system, but through the cycling, the system passes near this point. So the disorder that this anneal disorder, it develops long tails and kurtosis, so it's far from our Gaussian, it's correlated disorder. And you can also look at the evolution of these parameters k, which is an exponent, and lambda, and you see that lambda, for instance, becoming equal to zero near a particular value of tau, which is this critical value, while for low tau, so we also compared this model with the quenched model. So we introduced disorder as an uncorrelated Gaussian disorder, and that would lead us to this random field Blue memory Griffiths model, where S takes these three values, and we take H as a uncorrelated disorder, and the system has a critical point, and the exponents are the same as in our model, even though the critical temperature is in a different place here. So it looks like the correlations, and this is correlations in disorder, spatial correlations, so they don't matter because uncorrelated disorder brings us to the same value of this exponent, but it affects a critical point. So we also look...
We should probably...
Yeah, okay, it's the last slide. So, sorry, this is, we also looked at the reproduction number here and the activities, distribution of activities and the corresponding exponents here. And the reproduction number also is close to one near this critical tau C. So we expect that there is a critical point here. And the dynamics of this anneal disorder leads to a robust passing of the system near this critical manifold. So that's, those are my conclusions. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
The model that you have, to what extent is capturing what we do see in the materials? Is this a good modeling?
In terms of, it's still a scalar model, it's still a kind of a toy model, but it shows a robust criticality associated with the first order phase transition, even driven by temperature. So you don't expect here the pinning type of phenomena where you may associate it with a tilted energy landscape. So we think this captures the essence, but still what is unclear is why this disorder is bringing the system near this critical manifold, and what is the mechanism of self-organization, which is quite mysterious. For this, even simpler model is needed that would be more transparent so that this could be established.
But in that sense, it is similar to a little bit to the pinning models, right? I mean, in that, well, okay, in the pinning models, you drive it with the uniform tilt. Here you have a very different driving, but still, you know, the disorder basically, in some sense, partly depending on the driving as well, but the form of the driving together with the disorder creates a critical behavior, although the changes are kind of jump-like in avalanches, and it seems you have something.
Well, there you have a quench disorder, and you need this kind of demagnetizing effects, this long-range interactions to ensure that the system stays near the critical point, and the landscape, of course, is tilted. So here it's not tilted; it's shaken, and disorder is evolving. So it's more like this paradigm of this kind of sweeping, made proposed by Sornet, that there are secondary order parameters that couple to the main order parameter, and their coevolution in the appropriate coupling brings you to a critical point. That may be some connotations with this, but in fact, it's not. So I wouldn't immediately see parallels with the pinning.
It makes it more complicated and distinguishes it from.
So I think, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of questions, but since this looks like...
Like, maybe we should wrap this up for now, and we can continue discussion. But one thing I should just say here is that how many people have never seen a piece of this stuff? Mm-hmm. So I have a piece of stuff that we got from the teachers' conference that Sue brought, and so we can try this out later. Just so that.
What is this?
There's some night mall stuff. So it's. So I've already squeezed it into this shape, and we will see if it springs back to a line when we heat it up. That's the.
Yeah, I didn't talk about these features.
Yeah, but so this is. This is what? Yeah. Okay, so let's thank Love again.